Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 292, Limited Hangouts and Perception Management, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, January 11th, 2012. The guest on this week's episode is Mark Rabinowitz. Mark was the guest last summer on the 9/11 special, and he's also somebody that I had the pleasure of hanging out with quite a bit in and around the ASPO conference in Washington, D.C. last fall. ASPO, for those of you who don't know, is the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. Mark also suggested the musical interlude this week. The song is called Marion King Hubbert, and it is by Kurt Liebzeit. Kurt is a friend of Mark's, and Mark not only suggested that I play the song, but he also secured permission for me to play the song. So thank you to Mark for all of his contributions to this week's episode of the Sea Realm podcast. And speaking of contributions, the Sea Realm podcast is a listener-supported program, and this week's episode is sponsored by Valerie. Valerie gave a very generous donation to the podcast, and then she followed it up with an email in which she explains that while she's listened to the Sea Realm podcast, really, it is her boyfriend Brandon who is the truly avid listener. And she also asked that I give Brandon a shout-out because this Friday, the day after tomorrow, Friday the 13th, Brandon turns 40 years old. Happy birthday, Brandon. Thank you very much to Valerie and to everybody who contributes in one way or another to the Sea Realm project. I couldn't do it without you, really. In addition to providing not only the interview content and the music for this week's show, at least via association and his efforts, Mark Rabinowitz also suggested that given that the MLK holiday is coming up, I open the conversation with an excerpt from a speech that Dr. King gave on August 16, 1967, in Atlanta, Georgia. It is a speech that I had never heard of. I read through the speech and I listened to it, and I was amazed at first that I'd never heard of it, and that none of the very eloquent passages were familiar to me. And then I realized that this is a speech that is actually challenging power. It is actually challenging the logic of capitalism. Unlike the I Have a Dream speech, which, while certainly points out racial injustice, is also a very sort of power-friendly speech. A sort of touchy-feely, feel-good piece that doesn't challenge much other than abstract notions, whereas what you're about to hear challenges the very basis of our society, a basis which is not allowed to be questioned. Here is the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
I want to say to you as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are words that must be said. Now, don't think you have me in a bind today. I'm not talking about communism. What I'm talking about is far beyond communism. My inspiration didn't come from Karl Marx. My inspiration didn't come from Ingalls. My inspiration didn't come from Trotsky. My inspiration didn't come from Lenin. Yes, I read Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital a long time ago. And I saw that maybe Marx didn't follow Hegel enough. He took his dialectics, but he left out his idealism and his spiritualism, and he went over to a German philosopher by the name of Feuerbach and took his materialism and made it into a system that he called dialectical materialism. I have to reject that. What I'm saying to you this morning, communism forgets that life is individual. Capitalism forgets that life is social. And the kingdom of brotherhood is found neither in the thesis of communism nor the antithesis of capitalism, but in a higher synthesis. It's found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. Now, when I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated.
You're listening to the C Realm podcast and getting it all reconnected.
And getting it all reconnected.
And getting it all reconnected. And getting it all.
You are listening to the C Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and I'm joined on the phone by Mark Rabinowitz. Mark is an independent analyst. He looks at resource depletion and what some might call deep politics and a host of other things, and comes up with holistic and very sensible sounding explanations for things. And, Mark, we were just listening to Martin Luther King talk about the need for a synthesis, a higher synthesis between capitalism and communism. And we listened to that because you had sent me the clip. So what did you have in mind with this clip for the start of our conversation?
Well, I think the key theme of a lot of discussions as we start 2012 is what is euphemistically called the economy. And everybody has an opinion, of course. And there are more perspectives on this than we can attempt to summarize. But the reason for the clip from Martin Luther King is in sort of dissident, leftist, radical, whatever term you want to use, progressive circles, there's a lot of growing discussion about income inequality as one of the root causes for the problems that we're all facing these days. And King was in many ways a pioneer in social justice efforts, but the deeper approaches he was promoting for economic justice in his final year of political activism go beyond what is normally considered the left critique of economic inequality. To point out that we need a holistic approach that integrates both individual freedoms and social responsibility is a small hint of where we need to go. If King had survived, we would also be talking about the need to integrate ecological concerns into our economics. So one of the critiques I have of the Occupy movement, of the corporate rights and personhood movements, is not that I disagree with them in terms of economic injustice, but one of the things about increasing economic inequality is that the Wall Street powers that be, they can look at resource depletion and other core factors just as much as attendees of the ASPO conference or Transition Town movement, and their attitude is, well, if the Titanic is going to be sinking, they're going to make a rush for the lifeboats while everybody's listening to the band on the deck. In other words, a lot of the critiques of the system that we see from the progressives Democrats, left, etc., is seeing this as a cyclical recession or corporate greed. And these are certainly hints of where we're at. But it's not a cyclical recession. This is a permanent financial shift in the way things are, because we have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet. And I don't see that acknowledgement very often in appeals to deal with corporate kleptocracy or better income distribution.
Well, you and I were both at the ASPO conference in the fall. And on the last day of that conference, or actually I guess it was the day after the last day of the conference, we went to the Keystone XL pipeline protest, which was organized largely by 350.org, Bill McKibben's organization. And that was a very strange experience for me, because when I was there, you know, I had been to Occupy Wall Street a little while earlier, and Occupy Wall Street was a lot rougher around the edges, but it also provoked a much more overbearing police response. Even before the police, you know, went in and broke up the camp a month or so later, they were really on the scene. They had overwhelming numbers, lots and lots of military hardware on the scene, ready just to quash anything that was unexpected. And in Washington, D.C., for the Pipeline XL protest, one, it was really clearly organized by a single group. They were professionally made signs. People had on their orange vests. You know, they were just very unified. They seemed very hopeful, and there were almost no police anywhere to be seen. And it just all seemed as though they were working very much with the blessing of those who might otherwise be threatened, by those who certainly seemed very threatened by Occupy Wall Street. And I was rather put off by it. Occupy Wall Street seemed authentic to me, an authentic sort of protest, whereas the Keystone XL pipeline seemed like a sort of staged event where nothing was left to chance and there was no possibility that they would incur any sort of wrath because all the paperwork had been done in advance. It didn't seem like a real protest to me.
Well, it definitely had official protest permits and all of that sort of thing. But there's also a cultural difference, I would suggest, between protests in New York and in the core of the federal enclave in Washington, D.C. There have been more protests than probably even the FBI can keep track of in Washington. And generally, the response is let them happen. People wave their signs, they make their speeches, and then they go away. And then someone else comes and they do the same thing and then they go away. And the system can handle that very well. And I used to live in Washington, D.C. for many years and gradually realized that the banner waving was a way of letting steam escape. If you're going to turn up a pressure cooker, you need an escape valve. And things like that Keystone pipeline protest are a safe way for people to blow off steam. I don't think it's going to change the outcome in the long run, because as oil production continues to decline, the U.S. is going to increasingly covet the tar sand oil from central Canada. Whether it's polluting Canada's water or fouling the air is going to be secondary when there are oil shortages. I don't support it, but I think that's the painful truth.
You mentioned something at ASPO. You have a standard line that you give to environmentalists who are down on oil. And I don't want to steal your thunder by saying your line, so the spotlight's on you.
My attitude on fossil fuels and nuclear power is that I've been tinkering with solar energy for over two decades. I have solar electric. I have solar hot water. I bought these long before most people now saying we need to use solar. We're talking about this. Solar energy is great, but it's not going to replace fossil fuels. And most important, it's not going to transport food across time zones. And yes, the fossil fuel industry is one of the great destroyers of the planet and communities and corruption and toxic pollution, cancer, and you name it. There's a long list of things that the fossil fuel industry is doing to all of us. But we're all dependent on it. And oil is not just about gassing up your car and driving where you want. It's also about keeping the grocery stores full of food, and probably at an even deeper level, it is the consumption of fossil fuels that fueled the industrial economy that most people, even most environmentalists, enjoy. It allowed our population levels to zoom from 1 to 7 billion people over the last century and a half, and it runs virtually everything that we do. When I bought a kilowatt of solar panels, it took fossil fuels to drive them across time zones from the factory to my house. It took fossil fuels to mine the minerals that went into the solar panels and the wiring and the electronic control system and all the rest. So we're at the halfway point of fossil fuels, more or less, on planet Earth. We've used half, and we have roughly half to go. But the second half will be, as you know, much faster and probably more violent than the first half. So if we have a fixed amount of fossil fuels remaining, how do we want to use them? If we're going to put up a lot of solar panels and wind turbines and trains and bicycles and all the rest, that's going to require a lot of metallurgy. Metallurgy requires a lot of energy input. If we were to convert from the military-industrial complex towards things that we might actually want as the oil goes away, we might have a pleasant relocalized future on the downslope of energy. But that's obviously not the direction that civilization has taken. And unfortunately, there's not been much of a political pressure to make that kind of shift. Things like the Keystone protest and the climate change movement are baby steps in that direction, but I think it's too little too late. It's going to require a civilization-wide shift to make that happen.
One thing the Occupy Wall Street movement really did for me was provide the most clear and stark example of the difference between reality on the ground and the stage-managed presentation of that reality in the corporate media. And I noticed that at first the corporate media just tried to ignore Occupy Wall Street, hoping that it would go away quickly. And when it didn't, then they tried various narratives to discredit it. And the only thing that really seemed to get any traction, and it's the one thing they sort of latched onto and continued throughout all of Occupy Wall Street, was that the protesters are dirty. They smell bad. They are unshaved. They are unkempt. And if you listen to Fox News, you know, they're just defecating on the sidewalk and wallowing in their own filth. And because usually Fox News is not standing around describing what I'm looking at, you know, in real life, I don't have that stark comparison. But when I went down to Zuccotti Park repeatedly and I saw how clean they were keeping it and how they had secured all these brooms and scrub brushes and how Zuccotti Park was the one clean place in that portion of Manhattan. And then I would, you know, hear on the news that it's just wallowing, that the protesters are wallowing in their own filth. I was really struck. And what really struck me was that it wasn't just Fox News that was using that line, you know, playing on the cultural animosity and hatred of hippies and whatnot, but NPR was repeating that exact same line. Even in their top of the hour news stories where they have a dozen words maybe to devote to a subject, they would always get in the unsanitary conditions. That meme worked itself into every single corporate and pseudo-corporate narrative about Occupy Wall Street.
Well, it makes me glad I stopped listening to NPR after the first Bush attacked Iraq. I mean, NPR is basically not terribly different than Fox. They have a slightly different spin. But in terms of support for the system, they're really indistinguishable. Now, Fox is, of course, partisan Republican, and NPR is, of course, partisan Democrat, but neither of them will admit that. But in terms of support for the system, for the empire, for Wall Street, for transnational corporations, for foundations that provide NPR with a lot of their funding, the differences between Fox and NPR are almost too subtle to even care about. And the media is a huge part of the control system. It is one of the things that shapes the public consciousness. It shapes the political election. I'm convinced the political elections at the national level are rigged far more by media coverage than the old voting machines. The voting machines, of course, get some attention, as they should, but it's the way the media treats a candidate that determines whether they win or lose.
Since I've been paying attention anyway, every single presidential election has been the most expensive presidential election in history, and the winner has always been the person who spent the most money on advertising. Every single election, including the election of Barack Obama. I made a prediction, and you know, I'm sure it will be wrong, but I made the prediction that Ron Paul will win the popular vote, not that he would take office or not that he would get the Republican nomination, but that he would win the popular vote. I'm wondering if we might have a situation where Ron Paul wins because he raised the most money, he just didn't raise it from corporations. If perhaps that is a way in which the system's own mechanisms might come back and turn on it and sort of bite it in the ass.
Well, I would disagree with that prediction. I don't think Ron Paul is going to win any sort of vote. He will be doing very well to even win a single primary. He's clearly not the choice of the Republican Party establishment. I think the Ron Paul phenomenon is sort of a strange hybrid of the John Birch Society, which is essentially the Ron Paul point of view, and a lot of people who seem that they have nowhere else to go. I mean, I deeply respect that Ron Paul was one of three Republicans to vote against the USA Patriot Act, and on a number of issues I agree with him. But in some ways I think he's worse than the Bush-Cheney people, because at least they had to pay lip service to the need for environmental protection, whereas I've never heard Ron Paul say anything about the need for environmental protection. Perhaps I've missed it, but Paul's district in Texas is just south of Houston, and there's a huge amount of toxic petrochemical facilities there, and the libertarian ideal that the free market will somehow keep toxic pollutants from crossing property lines to protect you and your family, I just find that ridiculous. I mean, my choice for so-called president in 2012 is none of the above. I was never a supporter of Obama. He's pushing safe nuclear power and clean coal and expanding war in Pakistan and many other things that there's no way I could vote for him. And, of course, the Democrats don't have a primary this time. The Green Party has fizzled out, which is my political point of view. And at this point, I've come to the sad conclusion that the presidential election is like televised wrestling. It's a bruising contest, but it's fake. It's rigged in advance. And the prediction I'll make is Obama's been selected for a second term since he has done the bidding of Wall Street very well. Bush and the Republicans were very good at dividing the country for 8 years and pushing a Wall Street agenda. And now it's time for the good cop. And Obama is dividing the country very well, but from the other point of view, so this time it's the conservatives who are all riled up at who is in the White House. And meanwhile, there's not really that much difference between the political points of view. I mean, Obama on surveillance in some ways has been worse than Bush and Cheney. And it's difficult for the liberal civil liberties activists to oppose it because it's, quote, their guy who was pushing this. Just like when it was Bush in office, it was difficult for the principled conservatives to take a strong stance on it because it was their guy doing it. I mean, it's bait and switch. So I look at the presidential contest as just theater. I don't think it's actually real.
It might not be real, although real is a slippery word, but theater can be instructive. For example, sometimes in a debate with other Republicans, Ron Paul will say something that just smacks of obvious sanity, but something which is you certainly could never say in a, you know, Republican presidential debate. For example, in one debate, he made the point that fighting perpetual wars over resources, you know, if really what you're wanting to do is create global peaceful stability and, you know, a fair society and whatnot, that is absolute insanity. And while the major news networks played the clip of him saying that, they muted the audience response. But if you go back and, you know, hear what how the audience reacted to that, the whole room just burst into a huge roar of approval. And again, we've got the media saying, okay, here's crazy Uncle Ron saying his wacky, you know, we can't fight perpetual war stuff when obviously we have to. And if we don't have military bases in three quarters of the country of the world, then we're isolationist. So that's the mainstream Republican line.
here's Ron Paul saying something of obvious truth. Look, we can't fight perpetual wars forever. You just can't go on that way. The room bursts into a roar of applause and approval, and the mainstream corporate media mutes that and denies the reality of the response to somebody speaking sanity. And I think that regardless of whether he gets the nomination, regardless of whether or not he wins, if you have somebody who in the Republican debates is saying, look, the war on drugs is racist and cruel and motivated by all kinds of things that, you know, the perpetrators of it would never admit to. We cannot have a global empire and police the world, that, you know, we really need to bring our troops home and relate to other people, other countries through trade. Pointing out all of the problems with the Federal Reserve, something that no other Republican candidate will do, you know, at least not on camera. All of this helps to highlight the difference between the managed media perception of reality and actual reality, which is just glorious to me. It makes me happy every time I hear that, see that, every time the cracks widen. I think more people will start to see the difference between the simulacrum and the thing that is depicted.
Well, but at the same time, the media and the empire has gotten very good at having dissenting points of view that can be associated with discrediting ideas. So, rightly or wrongly, if the main thing that people hear about the occupiers is that they're dirty and they haven't taken a bath because they're living in the park, whether that's true or not, if that's the perception, then it gets associated with ideas that have to be discredited. You know, and for Ron Paul to be the figure in the media who is talking about the need to end the empire, well, some of his views on civil liberties and in Dixie, for a politician to say states' rights when it comes to civil rights, is a coded term that most racists understand very well. You know, and just saying end the Fed, but not talking about ecological limits to economic growth, doesn't really impress me that much. I'm certainly no fan of the Federal Reserve, but the Federal Reserve is a symptom of the problem. And the underlying core issue is we have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet. And even if we abolished the Federal Reserve and got rid of debt and went back to gold coins instead of paper bills and ones and zeros and computers, the Earth is only so big. And how to share a finite planet, I've never heard that from sort of the conservative anti-imperialists that Ron Paul is the standard bearer of. And that, to me, is a bigger issue than abolishing the Federal Reserve.
Perhaps, although, sure, other candidates will publicly wring their hands over environmental issues, but all of the policies they support will increase carbon emissions, and they will make the problem worse. So I'm not particularly impressed or comforted by somebody who acknowledges a concern but then does absolutely nothing to address that concern.
And the most famous example of that is your former senator in Tennessee, Mr. Albert Gore, who spoke very nice words about the need to protect the atmosphere, and then when he was in the White House, gave us NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and toxic incinerators and the Watts Bar nuclear power station and more highways and all the rest. When I went to see his film, An Inconvenient Truth, he at one point expressed remorse that his family had grown tobacco and his sister smoked tobacco and probably died from the health effect of smoking tobacco. But there was no mention of the fact that when he was in the White House for 8 years and the environmental desk was his, and the head of EPA and the Council of Environmental Quality were his former staffers, they didn't do anything about it. In fact, David Brower, who was one of the great leaders of the environmental movement in the 20th century, said in 1996 that Clinton and Gore had done more damage to environmental regulations than Reagan and Bush. And he was right. And it's because the environmental movement, when Reagan was in the White House, fought the administration and stopped a number of rollbacks. Not all, but they actually had some spine. But when it was the Democrats in office, they rolled over and let the empire do what it wanted. But at this point, no one can can really increase fossil fuel combustion, even if all the environmental regulations were abolished, because you can't burn fuel that doesn't exist. We're past peak oil. Peak natural gas in the United States was 1973. Peak coal is either here or near. When you have the coal companies going after foot-thick seams in Appalachia, that's a sign that the easy coal is over. It's one of the motives behind mountaintop removal, which is evil, but it's also a scraping of the bottom scenario, just like tar sands. I mean, nobody in their right mind would do tar sands unless that was left, or drilling for oil in a mile-thick water. I mean, that was one of those stories of the BP spill in the Gulf a year and a half ago, was why is BP drilling for oil in a mile of water? Surely shallow water or onshore would make more sense, but it's the low-hanging fruit argument. We've eaten the low-hanging fruit, and now we're going after the difficult oil that is much more expensive and much more energy intensive to get. And it's one of the reasons why environmental regulations are under attack, because going after the dirtier oil is more environmentally destructive, and the tar sands is a great example of that.
Well, Mark, we've come to the portion of the show where I play some music, and if all goes according to plan, the music will be of your selection, so perhaps you can introduce it.
Well, my friend Kurt Leibzeit in Portland has a song about the M. King Hubbert, the geologist who figured out the mathematical rise and fall of the world's oil fields. And in 1956, he famously predicted that the United States would peak in oil production around 1970, and the world would peak sometime around the turn of the century. Now, he was working for Shell Oil at the time, which was not happy that he published this research. But while he was ridiculed, he turned out to be completely correct. And Hubbert is lesser known for, in his later days, he became an advocate of solar energy and steady-state economics. We would have to move beyond growth-based money in order to deal with the energy crisis, because you cannot have endless growth in an economy that is not associated with endless growth in resources.
Well, let's hear that song now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more.
Born in 1903 in a town in East Texas, Marion King Hubbert was a tinkering lad. He built engines and telephones and other such gadgets, tending a farm with his mother and dad. Precocious in school, he left for Chicago for college at the old U of C. Doctorate capped off his studies at 30 in physics and geology. Marion King Hubbert took a job back in Texas. He worked for Shell Research and the USGS. He mapped out reserves all over the country, recording the places we'd found oil and gas. But Hubbert could see more clearly than most that the oil age had limited time. The question, he said, isn't when it would end, but when would it start to decline? Would the sun ever set on the oil fields of Texas? Would there come a time when depletion drew near? Charting demand, he then drew a conclusion. Production would peak in just 15 more years. His colleagues all laughed, for the oil patch was booming, pumping millions of barrels each week. For 15 more years, they all chuckled at Hubbert, till the day that domestic oil peaked. The world, he would say, is run by two systems. The first is the culture of money and time. If I loan you a dollar today in a year, pay back a dollar and dime that assumes that there's more and more tomorrow on the upslope. That's certainly true, but we can't keep on doubling the energy system. In the end, only physics will rule. Oil fields all follow predictable patterns. Production goes up as the wells come online. At some point, the next well you drill makes no difference, and the field at that point enters endless decline. What applies to one field or one country is true for the planet as well. We find but one barrel for each four we consume. Will this be the year output fell? Oil runs the autos, and oil runs the tractors. The food that we eat has an oil subsidy. There's oil in the plastics, and oil in our clothing. Oil powers ships that bring goods overseas. Oil drives the wars we are fighting. And I don't mean the tanks and the planes. The reason behind all the shit that's been happening, it's simply the oil end game. We're burning it now like there's no tomorrow. We're squandering all that remains. Let's plan for the future and retool our culture to a lifestyle that we can sustain. We're burning it now like there's no tomorrow.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast with your host, KMO.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO. I'm speaking with Mark Rabinowitz. Mark, you directed me to a portion of your website where you have a kind of table, and there on the left-hand side there are a number of subject matters, and then there are four entries for each subject matter. And the entries are the official version, the limited hangout, the version that is best supported by evidence, and then the deliberate disinformation about that topic. So, if you would, first, I hadn't heard the term limited hangout before looking at your website. So talk about a limited hangout, what it does, what it's for, and maybe an example or two.
Well, the term limited hangout is when a certain amount of exposure of a scandal is encouraged in order to keep the full scandal covered up. And the term, as far as I can tell, comes from the Nixon White House, where they're trying to figure out how much to release of the cover-up of the Watergate burglary. And they said, well, we could have a limited hangout. So you put out a piece of the truth, and people think it's the whole truth. And it's a very effective strategy. So, you know, this applies to more scandals than we have time to get into, but if you go to oilempire.us, you can read a long list if you click on the map, the political map button on the top of the page. But sifting the difference between best evidence and limited hangout takes a little more rigor. So, for example, with the 9/11, the limited hangout is that there was an intelligence failure where the federal government failed to connect the dots that would have alerted decision makers that the attacks were coming, when the best evidence is they actually had full foreknowledge that the attacks were coming and deliberately chose to let them happen. At least 15 countries provided detailed warnings that the attacks were coming, and there were even FBI agents tracking the hijackers who tried to stop the attacks but were blocked. That's the difference between a limited hangout and best evidence. On the other side of the spectrum, you have disinformation, sometimes deliberate, sometimes not, that is used to discredit looking into a story and alienating the public from looking closer beyond the limited hangout or the official story. And on 9/11, of course, there's an endless cottage industry of disinformation to keep people from looking at the fact of foreknowledge.
Well, I don't want to get too deeply into 9/11 disinformation campaigns.
But the same pattern works on ecological issues. It works on financial concerns. It works on the election. It works on just about any of the major scandals of the day.
So let's take a look at, say, peak oil through that lens of the four different narratives. The official version is, peak oil, what are you talking about? The limited hangout is what?
The limited hangout, I would say, is represented by most of the environmental groups. Certainly the big foundation-funded environmental groups say, yeah, peak oil, good. We need to get rid of oil. Oil is terrible. We're addicted to oil. And there's a lot of truth in that. But it's not so simple as to say, okay, well, oil is bad, oil is evil, and the sooner we stop using it, the better. Because our whole food system is totally dependent on it. Our financial system is totally dependent on it. Our industrial economy and civilization is completely dependent on fossil fuels. And it's not as easy as to say, well, we'll put up 1 billion solar panels and some wind turbines and we'll all live happily ever after. That's a crude simplification, but to say that oil is bad and we should stop using it, yeah, it's true, but it misses the main issue, which is we are totally dependent on it. And then if you look at the other end of the spectrum, if you delve into the peak oil world very much, you will find people say there is no such thing as peak oil. Peak oil is just a scam from the oil companies to make more money, or peak oil proponents want oil to go and attack Iraq or all these other places. And there might be a few who fit that category, but it's an inversion of the truth. To point out that there's a problem is not the same thing as to support a militaristic means of dealing with it. And unfortunately, a peaceful, progressive, environmental perspective on peak oil is very difficult to find in the United States right now. The transition movement is a step in that direction, but it doesn't really have much widespread recognition.
There is a disinformation narrative on peak oil, which says that there is so much oil under the ground in North America that the federal government and the oil companies and other conspirators are just having to run around like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to plug the leaks to keep the oil just from bubbling up to the surface. It's so plentiful.
Well, it'd be nice if it was true.
Well, Noam Chomsky thinks that would be terrible news. He thinks that peak oil is probably false because he takes people like Daniel Yergin seriously. And he thinks that that's bad news because peak oil would at least disrupt empire and the evil agenda of those who would have an imperial, a global empire.
Well, except Chomsky fails to understand that peak oil was a primary motive for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It reminds me of the bank robber Willie Sutton many decades ago who was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. Why did we attack Iraq? To grab the olive oil? Because Saddam was a bad person? There are lots of governments that are doing evil things. But we attacked Iraq because they had the second largest oil supply in the world. And controlling the oil is essentially control of the industrial economy. If you're in a desert, which way water flows determines where food can grow and where food cannot grow. In the industrial economy, which way oil flows determines what economies have growth and which ones don't. And we know Cheney is on record before becoming vice president talking about control of the world's oil and peak oil in particular. Peak oil was the primary motive for the attack on Iraq. There was a lot of nonsense and propaganda surrounding that, but when you turn that off, the motive was clearly peak oil. And now that we have subdued the country and we have our puppet in there, the U.S. is hoping to exercise control, maybe slightly more subtly. We have our puppets in place, but we also have the U.S. Navy controlling the Arabian Persian Gulf. We'll see if that happens to start a new war with Iran or not. Maybe, maybe not. But control of the world's oil supply is absolutely critical if you want to run the world as a global empire. I don't want to run the world as a global empire, but an authentic critique of militarism would look at resource flows and the control of resources, and oil is not the only one, but it is probably the most important one. But Mr. Chomsky is someone I used to respect tremendously when I was first learning about imperialism in college. But since then, I've also read about his defense of the Warren Commission, the cover-up of the removal of Kennedy from office. And my respect for Mr. Chomsky has diminished tremendously, since I find it difficult to trust any radical political theorist such as him who tells us we need to trust former CIA Director Alan Dulles and Gerald Ford in their view that Lee Harvey Oswald was supposedly the lone gunman in Dallas, which is not physically possible.
We're running out of time, so we don't have time to talk about it in depth, but if you would say a few words about this book by James Douglas, Unspeakable, or JFK and the Unspeakable.
James Douglas is a longtime peace activist who wrote a book called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, which is by far the very best book, not just on the JFK assassination, but on the American presidency that it has ever been my pleasure to read. And it's not focused so much on the ballistics of Dealey Plaza and how many bullets were fired or any of that kind of stuff, although that's in the book. But it's more that Kennedy, especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis, changed his mind on the Cold War, called off the nuclear testing program, called off the space race, and said we should have a joint expedition to the moon with the Soviet Union, started the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam, and thoroughly pissed off the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA by doing all of these things, which is the motive for his removal from office. And to tie it in with your state of Tennessee, in 1999, when the King family sued, Martin Luther King family sued the federal government for the assassination, James Douglas was the only writer who attended the entire six-week federal trial in Memphis. And a federal judge heard the evidence that the federal government had been involved in the assassination and covered it up, and that it wasn't James L. Ray who did it. And a jury found for the King family. Now, it's understandable that Fox and NPR didn't cover this, but The Nation and Mother Jones and Democracy Now! Did not cover it either, because this is a topic that is beyond the pale for any media in the United States, not just for the establishment corporate media, but it's also beyond the pale for the left alternative foundation-funded media, like Democracy Now!
Say more about that.
Well, it fits the limited hangout. So in the next week, you will probably see in Democracy Now! And perhaps other places a recognition that Martin Luther King spoke out against the war in Vietnam. And for any listener who has not listened to King's April 4, 1967 speech denouncing the war in Vietnam, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's one of the most important speeches of the 20th century. But to talk about King's opposition to war and not the evidence that the King family has put together that this opposition to war was a primary motive for the assassination of Martin Luther King, that is a classic limited hangout. It puts out part of the truth. King spoke out against war, not just for civil rights, but it fails to note the bigger story that this is what got him killed. And I think that is at the root of why politics doesn't work in the United States, because we're in collective denial that this kind of thing goes on, even though intuitively most people suspect it. But it's like having a family secret that you can't acknowledge. And it's more psychological than political at this point. And it's why the 2012 election is basically a freak show, and billions of dollars in advertising will be spent to talk about very little that's actually meaningful to anybody.
I'm tempted to bring it back around to Ron Paul, but I won't. Let me offer you the opportunity to wrap up the discussion in any way you see fit.
Well, our financial system requires endless growth of the money supply. This is a complex topic, but essentially money in the U.S. system is loaned into existence through debt and compound interest. And the monetary system, constantly getting bigger, worked on the upslope of resource consumption. The loan of today will be paid off by the increasing growth of tomorrow, and so on. Now that we have reached the limits to growth in terms of energy and many other resources, this system is breaking down. This is as much a root cause of the financial meltdown as greed on Wall Street, yet it gets far less attention. Now, the left progressive approach is to call for better income equality and to restart the economy. But a deeper view is that we have reached the limits to growth on a finite planet, and we need to shift away from a growth-based economy to a steady-state economy, where the total size of the economy does not grow. Now, this will be imposed in the short run as much by physical limits as deliberate choice. And a steady-state economy is a bit like a mature old-growth forest, where growth and decay are in balance. The size of the ecosystem has reached its physical limit. And a steady-state economy, to be fair, is not in operation on any large scale anywhere in the world. It's more of a theoretical model, but it's the best approach that I've come across that explains how we could adapt to ecological limits without wrecking the planet. One particularly good online resource for reading more about this is the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, steadystate.org. There's also the writings of Herman Daly, former World Bank economist, who is one of the primary theoreticians, D-A-L-Y. And there's material by him at thesteadystate.org. But the bigger thing just to keep in mind is the Earth is not flat, and it's not constantly getting bigger. It is round, it is abundant, but it is also finite. And anyone who's had a garden knows that if you put a bean in the ground, you will get a lot of beans come harvest time, but you won't get an infinite number of beans. And our monetary system assumes infinite growth is possible if you just apply more virtual money. And this is not going to be fixed by going back to a gold standard or abolishing the Fed or any of that kind of approach. We need to have an economic system that recognizes the Earth is only 8,000 miles across and it's not going to constantly get bigger. And how to ensure ecological economics while addressing social inequality is one of the great challenges of the time that we live in. My 2012 prediction is to do as much as possible to ignore the shouting in the so-called presidential selection and to focus instead on long-term trends, the limits to growth, peak resources, and spending as much energy as possible building as many alternatives. Instead of protesting, as good as that is, I would love to see some of that energy going to make locally owned, democratically run cooperatives. Because if people don't want to be dependent on large corporations they don't like, well, the alternative is not just to protest the corporations, but probably the most effective protest is to create local food systems, to create local currencies, and other systems that are more capable of running society. And we're going to make trials and errors along the way, and we don't all have to be in consensus over what the precise approach is going to be, because no one really has it completely figured out. But the more we can create local alternatives to global corporations, the more we can shift the power balance away from systems that are eating the earth for endless profit.
I think that's probably a very good place to wrap up the conversation. So, Mark Rabinowitz, thank you very much for participating on the CROM podcast and for all the things that you do prior to and post participation on the CROM podcast.
Thank you very much for the invitation again.
On the CROM podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
That was Mark Rabinowitz, and Mark is working on a book, so when that book is ready for order, or at least ready to be read, I will have him back on the program, if not before. I wanted to reiterate a couple of things that Mark said. First, he mentioned the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy. And back in episode number 46 of the CROM podcast, I spoke with Brian Check. And Brian, as far as I know, is half of CASE, or the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy. So check out CROM podcast episode number 46 if you are interested in that topic. And also on the topic of James W. Douglas and his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, I would direct you to an episode of Electric Politics. That is a podcast by George Kinney, and James W. Douglas was on the episode dated May 15th, 2009. And while I'm pretty sure I heard that podcast back in 2009, I have since downloaded it to listen to it again. And that's mainly on the strength of Mark's recommendation. Bruce Damer, the guest on last week's episode of the CROM podcast, wrote to me to ask that I mention that he and Lorenzo, that's Lorenzo Haggerty of the Psychedelic Salon podcast, are going to be doing a series of Terrence McKenna-themed appearances, and they have one on the weekend of June 15th through the 17th at Esalen. And that one's going to be a little spendy, I think, for my taste, but I know that some of you can afford it. I'm reading now from the Esalen website. Terrence McKenna, 1946 to 2000, has been described as a Copernicus of consciousness. He was an intrepid explorer of the psychedelic plane, a scholar of history and the human condition, and an optimist about the future of our civilization. This workshop will explore this man and his ideas in the auspicious year of 2012, when Terrence dreamed of what might be termed an exponential great crescendo of novelty. Workshop leaders Bruce Damer and Lorenzo Haggerty will delve deeply into Terrence's history, thought, and unfinished intellectual works, and will summon him back to life at Esalen through stories, song, and audio and video recordings. Bruce guided Terrence into virtual worlds in the late 1990s, and in this workshop he will continue with themes he and Terrence explored: cyborganic life, settling space, the coming augmented reality world, visionary exploration, and prospects for a reborn human civilization. Lorenzo will take us from 2013 into the emerging era of cyber-enhanced humans, immersed in a meme space stranger than we can suppose. Followers of Visionary Thinking will find this immersion into the trialogue of Terrence, Bruce, and Lorenzo inspiring, useful, and transformative as they seek their own life's path in the 21st century. As Terrence always said, find the others. I remember when I first left Amazon.com, I had the money and I had the time, and I was tempted to go and attend a weekend workshop with Terrence McKenna at Esalen, and I didn't do it. And you know why? I don't know why. I just didn't get around to it. I regret that. If you think you'd like to attend that workshop, but Dr. Google hasn't given you the answers that you are looking for in terms of finding information about the event, then send me an email. My email address is kmo@crealm.com, and I will forward your communication on to Bruce Damer, and he'll get back to you. Well, that is all the time that I have for this installment of the CRealm podcast. I don't have next week's episode even really formulated in my mind yet, so it could be anything. I hope that you will join me for that episode, regardless of what it turns out to be. And until that time, Brandon, I hope you have a happy birthday, and everyone else, I hope that you will stay well.